असतोमा सत्कमय तमसोमा ज्योतिर्गमय मृत्योर्मा अमृतं गमय। ॐ शान्ति शान्ति शान्तिः हरिः ॐ। मे द डिवाइन लीड अस फ्रॉम द अनरियल टू द रियल, फ्रॉम डार्कनेस टू लाइट, फ्रॉम डेथ टू इमॉर्टैलिटी। पीस 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 बी अनटू ऑल। So friends, I'm very happy to be here, and it's a very feel blessed to be sitting here in this holy temple. And I would like to share with you today some thoughts on Shiva worship. As I bowed down here and saw the different manifestations of the divine being, before I speak on Shiva, I would like to share with you my experience, one of the experiences at the MIT where I am a chaplain, about how sometimes it can be difficult for others to understand the significance of having all these different manifestations of the divine. Part of it is to do with just the problem of translation, because you might have heard a lot of debate about how Hinduism is a polytheistic religion, polytheism. They worship many gods and goddesses, as opposed to monotheism, worship of one god. The essential problem with that kind of formulation is that the word God and goddesses, now these are English words, and none of the Hindu texts are in English. And obviously there is something in the Hindu tradition which got translated into English as gods and goddess. What we have is Deva and Devi. And there is no reason why Deva Devi should be translated as gods and goddess, other than in the early 18th and 19th centuries, when many of these Indologists and scholars, they went to study the culture and religion of the people in the East, and they were the first ones to translate the Hindu texts into English. And so they translated this, the word Deva and Devi, as gods and goddess. And of course we have many Devas, many Devis, so we can many gods and many goddesses, as opposed to the one God worshipped in Semitic traditions such as Islam, Christianity and Judaism. And that set up the whole debate about worship of one God and worship of many gods. And it has nothing to do with the Deva and Devis we worship. So it's a problem of a translation really. And this, how it gets reflected, I will tell you. At MIT we have a religious life center where all the chaplains have their offices, and we have a notice board where the activities of the different religious groups on campus are placed. So one of the evangelical Christian group on the campus, they put up one poster. And that poster had four circles actually. And so it was this one circle with the picture of a man and several arrows from above. And these arrows represented the divine being. And this human being was this person. And below was a caption saying Hinduism, and a one-line description that Hindus worship many gods. So here is one human being and many arrows from above. The second circle had just one human being and one arrow, and it said Islam, Muslims worship one god. A third one had just one cross and said Buddhism, Buddhists worship no god. And because this poster was put by an evangelical Christian group, the fourth circle was a larger circle, And there was this one person and one big golden arrow, a thick golden arrow coming down, and said, Christianity, Christians worship a God who is loving, kind, and all big description. And I just waited for some days to see whether anyone would have a problem with that kind of a poster. And of course, very few students come there anyway, and so I think it just pretty much remained there until the next meeting of the chaplains. And then I brought up this subject and I said that while everyone should have the freedom to define their religious tradition in their own way, we have to be very careful when we try to define some other religious tradition. Because if we don't understand it properly, we'll be misrepresenting, we'll be distorting it. And it is for that reason that someone who is not familiar with the Hindu way of thinking can easily get confused, because we have so many apparently pictures of many different devas and devis here, and it is easy to mistake. Some Hindus themselves might be mistaken, but I think most Hindus realize that what we worship is one Ishvara, one Parameshvara, or one Paramatma, but that one Ishvara who can manifest in many different forms. If it is true that God is Sarva Shaktiman, that God is all powerful, then who are we to say God should have a form or God should not have a form? Or if God has a form, God can come in only one kind of form. Who are we to decide that? And so, recognizing the infinite power, the infinite potential of Ishvara, we recognize that that same Ishvara can appear to us in many different forms. So all these different devas and devis we have here are not, it's not a conference of gods and goddesses here. It's just one Paramatma, one Parameshvara, but appearing to different people in different times. Nor are these gods and goddesses decided by a committee of people. They didn't rose into committee and said, might be good to have one goddess for wealth and one goddess for knowledge. It wasn't decided by a committee of people. These are real, because the great sages, saints, rishis have actually seen them in their vision. So these are not conceived intellectually. These have a deeper reality in them. People have actually felt, people have actually seen Shiva, Vishnu, Ganesha, Devi. Not just seen them, they have the vision of these devas and devis have transformed their lives, have brought a deeper kind of peace, a deeper kind of joy in their lives. So when we come here and pray, when we come here and worship, we must recognize that it's not simply just being pious or religious. When we come here and pray, we are standing before a real presence of God, a divine presence, which is more real than anything that we perceive around us. With that faith, with that devotion, when we pray, we will see that we are filled with power, we are filled with strength. Only then can our prayers be answered. So simply praying mechanically will not help. Must feel, pray with the firm conviction that I am standing before the real presence of Ishvara, real presence of God. Now it is in that context I would like to say something about Shiva as a one sample case which would apply equally well to all other forms of the divine. We see that around each forms of these divinities, there is a whole mythology grown around it. They are not just individual devas and devis. There is a whole, usually there is a family, there is a story. So we know, of course, there is a family of Vishnu, there is a family of Shiva. And through the different stories, we hear about these devas and devis. These are not fairy tales. Each of these stories connected with the devas and devis has a message for us. There is something we can learn from it. Now look at, for instance, the personality of Shiva. We know, of course, Shiva is represented in both ways, most popularly through a symbol, through Shivalinga. But we also have the anthropomorphic representation of Shiva, and we know Shiva, his abode is Kailash. Have any of you visited Kailash here? Okay, then I'm the only one. So I visited there four years ago. And I can tell you one thing. When I went to Tibet and stood there before Kailash, there is something there. You cannot really put it into words. But when you stand there, you do not feel that you are just standing before a snow peak. You really feel there is a presence, and you can't describe it, you can't explain it, but you know you are standing, there is someone standing right in front of you. So whether or not you actually have a vision of Shiva or Parvati there, but you know that there is someone standing, and that feeling you can never get rid of as long as you are standing in front. So we know that according to our tradition, Shiva stays in Kailash, and the way the Shiva is usually pictured is very different. In some ways, the personality of Shiva is very different from the other devas and devis. Usually find most of our gods and goddesses have a lot of ornaments and jewels and a big crown and weapons. But Shiva is a pretty little bit unusual. You don't find any ornaments or anything like that. Rare. There is no crown, it's just his matted hair. No jewels or gold ornaments there. In fact, for Shiva you just have snakes. His necklace is one big snake. And no fancy silken clothes like Mahavishnu who wear. But Shiva's is just one Vyagra Charma, they call it, the tiger skin. And although Kailash is quite cold, but Shiva just puts this ashes on his body to keep warm. And many of these other deities will have, you see, we know that just as in modern times, we find that life would be so difficult if you didn't have a car. Same was true in those days too. Each of the deities had their own vehicles. And you know, many of these other deities have really great vehicles. Mother Durga has a lion, and Mahavishnu has a golden eagle, and so on. But Shiva's vehicle is a bull, and not even a young bull, an old bull. A young bull at least is useful. You can use a young bull for farming or breeding, but old bull is completely useless. But Shiva says, okay, you be my vehicle. And among the other animals around Shiva, so there's a scorpion and snakes, all the animals we are afraid of, whom nobody wants nearby, whom nobody wants to keep as pets. And so Shiva says, be with me. And all these Shiva's retinues again are not some great people, but all these you'll find in the descriptions we find in our Puranas that all people in the world whom nobody wants, the kind of rejects of every society, all these fellows are all Shiva's retinue. So we see one characteristic in Shiva, and that is all those animals or beings or whoever the world doesn't care for, the world doesn't want, Shiva says, okay, you come to me. And you are familiar with the story of the milk ocean. So the Kshira Samudra, it was called. And it was believed in those days that under the bottom of this ocean were a lot of treasures. And of course, who doesn't want treasures? And so these devas and asuras, the gods, well, I'm also translating as gods, but you know who I mean. These devas and devis on one side, and then these asuras, the demons on the other. Everybody wanted those treasures. But they were so deep down that neither of them could get the treasures out by themselves. And so, although they hated each other, they distrusted each other, but they collaborated because they knew that without each other's collaboration, they wouldn't be able to get the treasures out. And so, and then of course we read in the books, they used the Meru, Mount Meru, which was the largest mountain, as the churning rod. And they used this Vasuki, the big snake, as a rope to churn the ocean. And of course these devas are more intelligent, and so some can be more crooked also in some sense. So what they did was that they told these demons, okay, we'll hold the tail, you be near the mouth of the Vasuki. And the demons said, well, nothing happened to them. So they were holding at the mouth side, and then the devas were at the tail side, and they started churning the ocean. And once they started churning, wonderful things started coming up from the bottom of the ocean. And there is the Airavata, this one white elephant came up. And immediately Indra pounced on it and said, I want that. And Kamadhenu, and well, lots of things started coming up from the ocean. And whoever is free for all, whoever grabbed them, they grabbed them. But their main target was not these smaller treasures. It was believed that at the bottom of the ocean was one jar filled with amrita. And it was believed that whoever drank that amrita would become immortal. That's what everybody was really after. The other things are just like extras. And so everybody's waiting for that amrita. But after the smaller treasures came, before the amrita was to come, suddenly the whole water of the ocean, fume started coming. Then they found poison started coming up. It was known as Kalakuta. And everybody got afraid because that poison was so vicious, so powerful, it could have destroyed the whole world. And for all this churning of the ocean, everyone had gone there except Shiva. Shiva didn't care for all this. He sat in Kailash in deep meditation. So when this Kalakuta, this poison started coming up, all these devas and devis got afraid. All the devas ran to Shiva and said, now you have to save us, protect us. And then Shiva opened his eyes and said, what happened? He said, now this poison is coming, it's going to destroy everyone. Then Shiva had great compassion for them. Then Shiva just bends down, and in the palm of his hand, he takes that whole poison, just drinks it up. To save the world, he drank the poison himself. But he was such a Yogishvara, such a great yogi, such great control over himself, that after that poison went up to here, he said, okay, stop. Try that yourself and see. After eating, you need to say, ask your food to stop here. But Shiva was a yogi, so he could do that. And that poison, of course, could not harm Shiva, but it was so vicious that it made his throat blue. And that is how Shiva gets the name Neelakantha, one whose throat is blue. And then, of course, once the poison is gone, the devas and the asuras again went for churning because they are all waiting for that amrita, and Shiva goes back into his meditation. Then of course the story continues, what happened at the amrita, etc. Present we are not worried about that story. Now what are the things that we learn from this about Shiva? First thing we see is that a total indifference to what everyone is running after. We find he did not care to go for that churning of the ocean. He said, what is my ideal in life? He just stuck to that. The second thing was willingness to help, willingness to sacrifice in order to help the other person. A third thing we see is a willingness to accept. In fact, I remember there is a small essay on Shiva written by Sister Nivedita. I was about, I think, I was small. I must have been about 11 or 12 year old. And that was the first time I read that essay on Shiva. And some of the description that I mentioned to you, that was the time I read it. And when I read that Shiva does not reject anyone. If you go to any other Deva Devi, they may say, well, you are not fit, go. But Shiva is, if nobody wants you, come along. And 12. I really don't know what I was thinking when I was just 12 year old. But I felt so happy when I read that. And I said, here is this one Deva, no matter if, even if I'm rejected by anyone in the world, Shiva will never say no to me. It was such a, so inspiring to read that. So here is another characteristic of Shiva we see, that Shiva doesn't care for the fitness or not fitness of the people who come. If you are sincere, if you surrender to Shiva, he will accept it. Now, when we worship Shiva, therefore, when we pray to Shiva, we have got to remember these characteristics of Shiva. And when we pray to him, when we worship him, what we really recognize is the importance of these characteristics. It gives us assurance that Shiva will accept us. But more than that, the more we pray to him, these characteristics of his will also enter into our own life. Then we will see that just because everyone is running after something, I don't have to just follow that. I can see what is important to me in my own life. I can see what the ideals are in my own life and just stick to that without just kind of following the crowd, so to speak. Second thing we see from Shiva is that the urge, the capacity to help. So a worship of Shiva, therefore, is done in two ways. One worship, of course, we all do annually, is the Shivaratri, when we worship Shiva. But there is another worship, and that is, can we see Shiva in the hearts of all beings? That is what Sri Ramakrishna Paramahamsa, the guru of Swami Vivekananda, he taught. He called it Shiva Jnane Jiva Seva, that Shiva is not only in the temple, Shiva is not only sitting in Kailash, but Shiva is in the heart of everybody. So if a hungry person comes and I help feed that hungry man or woman, I may think I've done a great charitable act and I may feel good about it. But that can also increase my ego. It can make me feel, oh, how wonderful I am. I always help other people. But that doesn't help me. I mean, it helps those people, but my ego increases. And one day, if this pride increases, pride will lead to a fall. So what can I do by which I'll be able to help other people, but without becoming egoistic? And Sri Ramakrishna taught that if it is true that God dwells in our heart, then we cannot say, God dwells only in my heart, but not in the hearts of any of you. That doesn't make sense. So if God is in my heart, God is in the heart of everybody. So when I help somebody, that help is not really a help. I am worshipping the God who is in the heart of that person. So when we do namaskaram, we do namaskar this way, we might say, well, I can do namaskar in a temple to God. Why should I do namaskaram to any other human being? But we know that in the Hindu tradition, it's very common. When we greet each other, actually, we might think that shaking hands is a Western custom. Not really. If you read the Bhagavata, in the beginning of the Bhagavata, when this Mahavishnu and Brahma, they met, they shook hands. The word used in Sanskrit is karasparshana. They touched each other's hand. There is a precedence for shaking hands even in the Hindu tradition. But when we do namaskara really means that I see the presence of God in you. So when I do namaskar, it's not to a human being, but seeing God in your heart. So when a person in need comes to us and we serve that person, what we are really doing is we are serving the divine who is in the heart of that person. So God can be worshipped not simply through flowers and incense and sandal paste. God can be worshipped through many different ways. If you are a teacher, then your teaching experience will become more enriching if you look upon your students as not just, oh, I've got to teach this fellow something and then somehow go home. Instead of that, you can say, God has come to me in the form of these students. So giving education, God has chosen, Shiva has chosen to come to me in the form of these ignorant fellows. Now giving education is a way I must worship that Shiva in that. If you are a physician, if you are a doctor, then God comes to you in the form of your patients. And if a patient comes, you can't say, now let me give you some flowers and incense. That's not the way to worship that God. So giving proper medicines and treating that patient, that would be the way to worship the divine being. So whichever way a person in need comes in front of us, if we fulfill that need and remember that there is God in that person, then that would be also a Shiva worship. So Swami Vivekananda said that if you see Shiva only in a temple or only in an image, then your worship is not complete. But if you are able to see Shiva inside the temple as well as outside, then alone we can say we are worshipping Shiva. And Swami, in that connection, Swami Vivekananda told one nice story. And he said that there was one rich man, and he had a big garden, and he had two gardeners, and so they would take care of the flowers and the fruits and so on. And whenever the rich man visited that farm, so one of the gardeners, he would go there in front of that wealthy person and simply say, oh, how wonderful you are, how beautiful are your eyes, and so on, just go on praising that rich man. But the second gardener, he didn't do that. He continued to work silently in the garden, and then through his hard work, wonderful flowers and wonderful fruits came up. Now Vivekananda asked, which of these two gardeners will that owner be pleased with, that employer be pleased with? Not the one who is simply going and praising him, the one who is actually working and doing the work that was given to him. So similarly, if our practice of religion is restricted only to going to a temple and ringing a bell and then doing arati and then chanting some hymns, all these are important, all these are good. But if this is all that we do, and then when we go home, we neglect our duties, we neglect our responsibilities, we don't do our work properly, will Shiva be happy with such a person? Or will someone who is very careful, does their work properly, do their responsibilities, duties in a devoted way and help the needy, will Shiva be pleased with that person? So the second type of person is the one who is worshipping Shiva in the truest sense of the term. So this is one point I would like to share with you. And do we have some time? Okay, so I'll tell you one small story and then we can stop. This story is about, you are all familiar with Narada. So he oftentimes is described in our books as he's a great devotee of Narayana. He'll go like Narayana, Narayana, he'll go everywhere. And there is a reason why he's always traveling. It seems that when this Srishti, when the creation started, Narayana, this Narada, whoever these first four children of Prajapati who were sent to Narada for to learn. Narada was their tutor, and Narada gave them such, filled them with so much vairagya that they immediately gave up everything and went to the forest. And then this Prajapati said, oh my God, then how will this creation continue? He is making everyone renounce the whole world. And so then they said the best thing would be not allow this Narada to stick in one place. Because if he is in one place, then he will go on telling people to give up everything. So he was therefore cursed. You will never be able to sit in one place. And so you find this poor Narada going all swarga, narak, patal, everywhere, simply taking, urging people to take the name of God, but not able to stay in one place for a long time. Then one day it so happened that Narada was going and he saw that suddenly one place was beautiful. The spring had just come, the birds were chirping, everything was greenery, and there's a mountain there and stream flowing. And naturally, Narada's mind got lifted to a very high state. And he said, let me sit down and meditate. And he sat down there and entered into deep meditation, which was very unusual because he was cursed never to be able to sit in one place. But he went into deep meditation. And as usually you will see, when someone starts like this, goes into a deep meditation like that, the Indra's position in heaven starts getting dwindled. He thinks, oh, somebody is now going to take my place. So Indra became very upset. He thought, oh my, I must do something now to break the meditation of this Narada. And so what he did was, he sent all his apsaras, and that there is Kamadev, Cupid, to go and distract this Narada. And so all these apsaras came, they started singing and dancing, and this Cupid, this Kamadev, he started shooting arrows of love in his heart so that he'll get distracted. And Narada's meditation could not be broken. And so even this Kamadev got afraid. He said, no, I was completely unable to break his meditation. Finally, he remembered, he had tried to do that once before to Shiva, and Shiva had burnt him to ashes. So now, and at least he thought another one replay will happen. So he then went and surrendered to Narada and says, please forgive me, nothing personal against you, just Indra sent me, that's why I came. And all these apsaras also got afraid that if this Narada will now curse, what will happen to us? They also sought forgiveness, and then Narada opened his eyes and he suddenly saw all these people forgiveness. Then he said, okay, I forgive you all, and they all went back. It is only then that Narada realized that he was sitting in one place for a long time. And then it struck him. He said, I have overcome that curse, and I have overcome, of course, I was not distracted by all these people coming, so I have conquered lust, and I did not even get angry at them, so I have conquered anger. And the Gita itself says, one who has conquered lust and anger, such a person is the greatest person in the world. And so Narada says, in all humility, it looks like I am the greatest person in the world. And naturally, if you have done something great and no one has seen it, then you are not very happy. You want to go and tell others about, so people can appreciate you. So then Narada goes to Brahma's house, knocks on the door. Brahma opens the door and says, and then Narada says, you know, this is what happened, and narrates to him everything that happened. And then Brahma says, oh, you are really very great, you are wonderful. But Brahma says, do one thing. Whatever you do, don't go and tell this to Shiva. And then this Narada says, why is he telling me not to tell to Shiva? Because he thinks, Brahma feels that the whole world will then appreciate me, and then no one will care for him, so they want to keep my greatness hidden. And he says, of course I'm going to go and tell Shiva about it. And so next he goes to Kailash, and Shiva welcomes him, and he narrates all this story to him. And Shiva also says, oh wonderful, you are really great. And then, but Shiva says, you have told me, that's all right, in private, but don't go and tell Mahavishnu, never go and tell him. Again Narada feels, why are these fellows telling me I shouldn't tell others? Of course, if I am the greatest, the whole world should know about it. And so next he again goes to Mahavishnu and then tells him the whole thing again. And Mahavishnu welcomes him and says, "Oh, that's wonderful. And I'm so blessed that you came to our home and then you have now done this." Actually, in a normal situation, Narada would have been very puzzled because he is all the time taking Mahavishnu's name and Mahavishnu treating him like this and, "I am so blessed." But by this time, this Narada's ahankara, egoism has become so strong that he thinks it's perfectly normal for Mahavishnu to feel that he is blessed by Narada's visit. And then Mahavishnu says, "Well done, and so very good, and come now and then like this and give us good news." And so Narada leaves. Then, still not satisfied after telling Brahma, Vishnu and Maheshwara, he wants now to go and announce it to the whole world. So then now he starts on his yatra. But then when he is traveling, suddenly he sees one golden kingdom has come up. And he says, "I have gone all over this world so many times, but I have never seen this kind of a kingdom before. How come this is a new place?" So he goes there and he finds that everyone is kind of getting ready for some special event. The whole kingdom is getting ready for something, and he says, "What's happening?" And then they said, "Oh, there is a princess of this kingdom and she is going to get married. And so the preparation for a Swayamvara are taking place." And so then Narada says, "Oh, wonderful." And so he says, "Let me go and meet the king of that place." And so when he goes to the palace, the king welcomes him, because Narada is a famous rishi. So the king welcomes him and says, "Oh, we are so blessed that you have come here. Please come." And then he says, "Now that you have come, I am about to preparing for my daughter's wedding ceremony. And since you know the past, present and future, could you please look at my daughter's hand and see what kind of a husband she's going to get?" You know, palm reading. And so he said, "Oh, sure." And so then his daughter comes. Her name is Vishwamohini. And as soon as Narada sees that daughter, he immediately falls for her. He says, "I have never seen a more beautiful woman than her." Anyway, so when she shows her palm to Narada, and Narada sees in her horoscope, it's written, the palm shows that she is going to marry the greatest person in this world. A person who is adored and worshipped by all. And Narada feels, "Oh, of course that's me." and then he doesn't, but he kind of controls himself. He doesn't immediately tell what he sees in that palm, and he tells her that, you are going to get a very good husband and so on. And then Narada's mind is thinking, "Oh my God, I never knew that I am going to marry this girl, and she is the most beautiful girl in the whole universe." Then suddenly Narada realizes that although he is the greatest person, it is true because he has conquered lust, he has conquered anger, but he says he doesn't really feel he is beautiful enough. Still there is a feeling. And so what he does is, he says, "Well, Mahavishnu has always been my great benefactor. And so I better go to Vishnu and say, give me your, because Vishnu is so beautiful. I want the beauty of Mahavishnu." So he goes to Mahavishnu and says, "Lord, you have told me that I can ask you whatever I want. Now I have one request. Give me your form." And Mahavishnu says, "Of course, you are my greatest devotee. Whatever you ask for, you are given." "Given," he says. Now Narada feels, "Now I am the most beautiful person, but I have had Mahavishnu's form. And then of course, I am of course the greatest, there is no question about that." And then when the Swayamvara time comes, and these great prince and princesses from everywhere have arrived there, and all are sitting in a line, and Narada also goes and sits, and then that princess is to come with a garland, and she is going to put it before for a person she chooses. Now it so happened, the two fellows were not really princes, but they have also come there. They are looking at Narada and making faces at him and laughing. And Narada is wondering, "Who are these fellows? What are they doing?" Anyway, he just sits there. Then this princess enters, that Vishwamohini, with a garland. And one by one, she passes through these different princes who have come. She doesn't garland any of them. And Narada is very sure, he's sitting in one corner there, thinking that of course she's going to marry me, so how will she garland anybody else? Then when she comes in that row where Narada is sitting, she just looks, Narada is sitting there, and she's so disgusted, she doesn't go to that entire row, she refuses to go to that row. And then she kind of rejects everybody in the hall. But then everybody's wondering, who is she going to marry? And as she has finished through the whole lot, the main door opens. And then Mahavishnu completely comes on a golden eagle, the lands there, comes into the door, Vishwamahini goes and garlands Mahavishnu. And he takes her off on the golden eagle and goes away. Then this Narada is furious. He says, what? This Vishnu himself wanted to marry her and he has kind of fooled me, cheated me like that, and he's really mad. And then those two fellows who are making faces at Narada, they say, don't get so mad like that. First go and see your face, they say. He said, what's wrong with my face? Go and see. In those days there were no mirrors, so he had to really go in one pond and see his reflection. So only then he saw, he really had a pig's head. Because, and he got mad. He said, I told Mahavishnu to give his form. But you see, Mahavishnu, he didn't tell which form. Mahavishnu has come even Varaha Avatara. And so he said, okay, this is also my form. So he had given him a pig's head. His poor Narada had no idea. And obviously that princess was so mad that a pig's head fellow has come. So she hadn't gone to that row at all. And then he really got angry. He said, Mahavishnu has cheated me. And then, and in the meantime, those two fellows who are laughing at him, then Narada, because whatever it is, Narada is a great rishi. He curses those two fellows. You fellows, you have made fun of me like that. You will be born as demons, rakshasas, in your future birth. Then he goes to Vaikuntha and he asks the Lord, Mahavishnu, why did you do like that to me? And Mahavishnu said, you asked me for my form, you didn't specify which form you wanted. I picked up one of the forms and gave it to you. And by that time, of course, Narada had understood that ahankara, that ego which had come. But before that, what happened? Before that, his ahankara went, he was so angry. In that anger, he curses Mahavishnu. Now that's the beauty of our Hindu tradition. Anybody can curse anybody. And it's effective. Narada curses Mahavishnu and says, you brought me so much pain because I loved this woman, and then the pain that you brought by separating me from someone I loved, you will have to take birth again and you will also suffer the same pain of separation. And only after saying that, when the Lord and then Mahavishnu said, oh, I am blessed by your curse and I accept. Mahavishnu didn't have to do it, but he wanted to fulfill the word of his devotee. And Mahavishnu said, I voluntarily accept your curse. Only then this Narada, suddenly that ego goes away, and then he realizes what he has done and he just falls at the feet of Mahavishnu and says, please forgive me, I don't know. And you see, it's a wonderful story. It has a lesson for us. When we become egoistic, when we are overcome by anger or lust or ambition, we don't know what we are doing. We do all wrong things. And later we regret what we have done, what we have said. That's what happened to Narada. Only afterwards he realized, oh my God, I've been behaving like a fool all this time. And then of course he seeks forgiveness and Vishnu forgives him. And then Tulsidas then goes on to say that is why then Mahavishnu took birth as Rama. And then the separation, when Sita was taken away by Ravana, the kind of pain that Rama felt was a voluntarily taken by Vishnu to fulfill the word of his devotee. And so this story is a lot of lessons it has for us. But I just remembered it since Ram Navami is on Tuesday, the birth of Rama. And today you're having Sita Kalyanam or something. So I thought it was a good occasion to remember something connected with Rama's life also. So it's been a great joy to share with you some of the thoughts and some of the ideas regarding the different devas and devis that we worship, what they mean to us, and how we can derive inspiration from them. Om Jananim Saradam Devim Ramakrishnam Jagatgurum Padapadme Tayo Shritva Pranamami Muhur Muhu. We bow down to Sri Ramakrishna and Holy Mother again and again.
We have to look into everyone and we have to help everyone, thinking like he is God. But after helping, like the other person, if he takes help and if he is never satisfied and cheats you back.
And?
If he cheats, like we feel bad. Same time, and we don't want to help anyone. And so if that situation comes, then what should we do?
Well, first of all, in helping others, there are, in the Gita says that dānam is of three kinds. There can be sattvic dānam, rajasic dānam, tamasic dānam. So normally what we study, satpatraya dānam in Sanskrit. What means that help should be given to those who deserve it. You see, it's like if someone comes to you and says, no, I want to go and blow up that building. Can you give me some money because I want to get some ammunition? Then you say, well, here is a person in need. Should I help him? Clearly, that kind of help won't be. So first of all, we need to help the people who will use it, use that help for a good purpose. So giving help at the right time for the right reason to a right person is important. Having said that, once I give help, what brings me pain is not helping, but my expecting something in return. So they say, asha hi paramam dukham, nairashyam paramam sukham. The greatest sorrow is expectation. One who doesn't expect anything from others is the happiest person. So if it is in your nature to help whoever is a worthy person in help of need, you help that person. Whether that person is grateful to you or not, that is not your question. But if I'm kind of hoping, oh, if I help somebody, that person should be grateful to me, that person should praise me, or that person should at least say a thank you, and if that person doesn't do it, then of course it'll upset me. But real karma yoga means that I help and there the matter ends. I don't expect anything back. Then, yeah. But if you are expecting something back and if you don't get it, then it is going to be painful.
I had one question. Like when we, I was reading somewhere that though we have different forms of the God and we can worship different forms of the God, depending on which God you are going to worship, go to different levels of Svarga, and only if you ultimately worship Krishna or Vishnu, you enter a world where you are not going to have a rebirth. So how are you going to reconcile these statements with the different manifestations of God?
Well, if you are entering into some world, if it is possible to enter into a world, it's possible to exit from that world also. So there is no such thing as if you enter into I mean, really, if people who say like if you go to a world of Mahavishnu or Krishna, like that's the highest world, are the people who are worshipping Mahavishnu or Krishna. I mean, if somebody is a worshipper of Shiva, they'll say Shiva's is the highest world. Now, which world you put higher will depend on which deity you are worshipping. But what Hindu philosophy says, what our Vedas say, is that the goal is not to go to some world, because the Gita says, Krishna himself will say in the Gita, A Brahma Bhuvana Lokas Punaravartinorjuna. A Brahma Bhuvana, in the Brahma Loka, is considered by the Shastras as the highest Loka. There is no Loka higher than Brahma Loka. And A Brahma Bhuvana Lokaha. And what Krishna says is, all the Lokas, including the highest Loka, Punaravartino, means nobody can stay permanently in any Loka, whether you call it Mahavishnu or Krishna or Brahma Loka, anything, no permanent stay. It's like if you go for a vacation to Hawaii, as long as you have your hotel booked there, that much time you can stay. Once your booking is over, you have to vacate. So going to different lokas is dependent, their booking is depending on how much punyam you have. So depending on what punya you do, that much you stay once, and then every enjoyment you get in these lokas is spending these punya dollars. And one day it's going to get exhausted. We don't have infinite punya. Once it gets exhausted, they say, okay, time to vacate and be reborn again. So going to any of the lokas is only a temporary vacation. You have to be reborn. The goal, therefore, is not going any to loka. The goal is to become free, moksha. Moksha does not mean going to any loka. Moksha means just being free. Shankaracharya, in his commentaries on the Vedas, on the Upanishads, says that all of the lokas are still a part of samsara. So just like this earth and this particular plane of existence where we are now is a chain in this circle, all the heavens you can think of, all the lokas you can think of are also in this circle. They are all part of samsara. The highest goal, if you want to be permanently free, is moksha, which means getting out of it. And so there is no question of reconciling. All worlds are ultimately same. So either we choose to remain in samsara or we choose to get out of it. One good thing is no one is pushing you out unless you want to. So we have complete choice. If you say, I'm not in a hurry for moksha, I'm quite happy going around, fine. I mean, there is really no hurry also. There's infinite time ahead. As long as we are in a merry-go-round, there is no reason why we should get out. At some point, the merry-go-round becomes a sorrow-go-round. Then we want to get out of it. So we have the freedom to decide when to get out. And everyone has to decide for themselves.
Yes,
moksha means realizing that divine alone exists. There is no in you. You see, the thing is, when we say in you, it's like water in a glass. When you say water in a glass, then of course glass itself is not the water. So when we say divinity in me, it really says I'm not divine, but there is kind of divinity in me. But that's not what it is. When you say moksha really means the divine alone exists. There is nothing in this world apart from the divine. The moment I have the notion of I or me, it's still a presence of the ego. And so that notion of I and me, ahamta and mamata, that has to go completely. Then only just the divine remains, and that would be moksha.
I have a question. Yes. Sorry, I have
a question. Yeah, okay.
The story that you described, Chirasangara Makala, is that a metaphor for the going inward? I mean,
well, sure, yeah.
As we meditate or go deeper into yoga, the things that come
sure,
out.
Sure, yeah.
The good and,
okay. Yeah, all of these Puranic stories are metaphors. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I just had a question about the symbolism of seeing Shiva in somebody. And you explained it, but I guess I didn't quite get it. I just wanted a clarification in case, kids ask. Why would one want to see Shiva in somebody and not Ram? Because we teach children see Ram or Krishna in somebody.
Oh, fine, you see Ram. That's
me, but you gave some explanation and I guess I didn't.
No, there is no particular. I'm not very kind of fanatic about seeing only Shiva in others. Uh-huh. If somebody is a worshipper of Rama, they can see Rama in others. They can see, you can see anybody really. Because essentially, Shiva and Rama are not two different people.
Yeah.
And so, I'm quite comfortable with seeing Rama and others too.
Right. But when you started the Puranas part of it, you said something and I didn't stay. I missed it. Yeah.
Well, I don't know what something that something is. So I don't know what you missed. Yeah. I don't know. Maybe later you can hear the tape because I don't know what you are referring to. Yeah.
It will be there on the website.
Yeah,
we'll put it up on the website.
You can download.
Download is good.
Okay. All right. Okay. Thank you, everyone.